So I've been training this for a little bit now, and I get to see a lot of people come in here, become pretty regular. And I know Brian here used to come in here a good bit, and it's been nice to be able to meet him and get to know him a little bit. And I'm really looking forward to hearing his story tonight. With that, I'll give you Brian.
Thank you. Brian Bosnick, alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 1st, 2015. My home group is the Fifth Tradition Group, and my sponsor and his sponsor are members of that group, and I get to see them all the time, which is great. It says in the big book, and talking about the stories in the back mostly, but it says our stories disclose in a general way what we were like, what happened, and what we are like now. And that's hopefully what I'm going to talk about tonight. I'm looking forward to hear what I have to say, too. I was born in 1966 in Maryland. My dad worked, my mom stayed at home. I had a brother and eventually a sister. We moved to Georgia when I was six, and my sister was born here, so three of us. And my mom did really well. I think she raised us to have good manners, good grammar, to be polite, and I forgot most of that for a while, but I still remember it, and I try to use that today, and I've thanked her for it recently. Because she really did make an effort. She also made an effort to put books in my life. She'd go to the library and buy all these books that had been the library was selling. So I had all these really old books on my bookcase in my room, classics that I had no idea what was going on in Hans Brinker or anything like that. But, you know, I had a lot of reading material, and that was really my first escape was reading. I always was looking for an escape anyway, or at least I didn't know that I was, but I was, and reading was my first escape. I read a lot. I read anything I really could get my hands on, and just read a lot of those books, a lot of library books, and music was also it was fun for me, but it was also an escape. By the time I got old enough to have my own record player in the 70s, an 8-track player for a while in my room, you know, I'd sit in my room and just listen to music, or lie on the floor and listen to music, and you know, I went out with played in the woods and in the creek and all that with my friends, and you know, play with the G.I. Joes. You know, we had the big G.I. Joes back then, and that kind of stuff. You know, so I definitely went and went out and did stuff with people, and wasn't completely introverted, but not very socially well developed. So didn't like hang around with a group of people. Just kind of played with the kids in the neighborhood, and pretty much kept to myself. Now I always wanted some sort of attention, but not too much. Just you know, you can like laugh at something silly that I do, but don't try to have a conversation with me because I won't know what to say. And I was pretty awkward socially for most of my life. And I guess the drinking really didn't start really with any regularity until I was in high school. I mean, we had wine at Christmas; it was probably watered down. And you know, there was by the time I was. I guess 16, 17, you know, I was able to figure out ways to get beer and would drink pretty regularly. My friend would come over when my parents were out of town for the weekend, and we'd get a 12-pack and get drunk, or we'd have a couple other people over and just started drinking screwdrivers. Of course, my friend's favorite drink, which I never, still to this day, don't understand why somebody would want to drink Captain Morgan Spiced Rum and Pink Grapefruit Juice, but that's what my best friend liked to drink. It didn't taste that bad, really, but it was kind of odd. Anyway, he was my friend, so it was no wonder he was odd. So did that pretty much a lot, but I drank. You know, I didn't drink really socially. Like I didn't hang around with the group of kids at my school that drank and, you know, drank MD-2020 and threw up behind the restaurant or whatever. Those people were not the folks I hung out with. I would just drink just to drink. You know, the dog had puppies and a puppy died, and I was probably 17, and I said, oh, I need a drink. You know, I'm 17, and I'm thinking I need a drink. And my parents had liquor, so I'm, you know, mixing a Jack and Coke, and like, oh, I feel so much better now, whatever. By the time I was 18, I was pretty much driving around with a bottle of vodka and little bottles of orange juice under the seat of my car. I had a seat that would fit that under there so I could mix a drink anytime I wanted. And just by chance, someplace that I was working, I met a guy who said, do you smoke? And I was like, yeah, I smoke. And then I thought he was talking about cigarettes, and we went to throw the trash out. It was not cigarettes. and I got started on another substance. Did that quite a bit. Always went back to alcohol as a mainstay, and just drinking pretty much all the time. And there was something that I knew that it wasn't right. There was some part of me that knew that this wasn't right. This isn't really what I'm supposed to be doing. And it could have been, you know, the way I was raised. It wasn't a strict Catholic upbringing, but, you know, that whole, you know, the intention and all the dogma and doctrine, you know, it got to me, I guess. It stuck with me, and it stayed with me even after I, you know, stopped going to Sunday school. I went through the whole thing, you know, the whole First Communion, First Confession, all that, confirmation. I don't remember a thing about it. I don't remember, like, feeling close to God or getting in touch with God or thinking that, you know, I was having some spiritual experience or that I had the Holy Spirit in me or any of that kind of stuff. I just remember that was what I was told to do, and it was expected, and therefore I did it, and was pretty much as disruptive as I could possibly be all the time. I got, you know, I wasn't one of those violent kids, but I was so disruptive in my Sunday school class that the teacher wound up crying, and they wound up transferring me to a different class on a different day. I was going on Sunday, and they transferred me to a Wednesday night class, which was weird because when we moved, after we'd been in Georgia for a while, we moved to another house, and for some reason my parents thought it would be a good idea, even though I was in sixth grade, we moved to be in fifth grade. And my grades weren't that good. I mean, I could pick up things, and I had intelligence, but I just wasn't, you know, student-wise very good, and the grades weren't good, so they did that. So I wound up being in a Sunday school class, where CCD, it wasn't on Sundays, in Sunday, but with kids that went to the same school I did but were in a different graded school than they were in CCD, which was it was pretty awkward. I thought I lied my way out of it, but I'm sure they knew that there was something weird. And lying was a big thing for me, too. I lied about everything. I could just lie. I would lie to get out of anything. And it was so prevalent that when I brought the girl home that was to be my first wife, after we left, she said, "You know what your mom told me?" I said, "What?" She said, "You would lie to get out of anything." So that's what my mother is espousing to someone that I intend to be with, which was, you know, if that's any indication of how bad the lying was. And so, you know, I was going around, you know, drinking all the time, and, you know, I'd hang out with people and drink, usually one or two people or a group of guys drinking and getting high, and just, you know, was, you know, pretty pointless. My life was pretty pointless. I got a job in a supermarket. I was working there and just, you know, basically working there, living at home, drinking and trying to have a good time and just thinking I was enjoying life. This jacket is way too hot. But I was pretty miserable, and when I wasn't feeling right about it, but I was still doing it because I didn't know what else to do. And when we got busted with a garbage bag full of bottles and, you know, whippets and all kinds of other stuff, and my parents came home early from the weekend, I had a couple people over, my mom was like, you know, "You should get help. You can get help. If you want to keep living here, you can get help." And, like, I was scared to death of moving out on my own, so I thought, let me go see what this help is, find out what that's all about, see if that's anything. And I went to a regional kind of county facility, and I didn't let them talk me into anything. And they got me, they started with inpatient, and I said no, and they said outpatient, and I said no, and then they got me to go one night a week. But the guy said, "Get with the folks in AA." I said, "They're good people." And I said, "Okay, well, I'll do that." So I went to my first meeting on August 24th, 1987, and I felt comfortable immediately. I really felt like that these people were just like me. They talked the way I did, they drank the way I did, they used other substances as I had, and they had found a solution for it. And, you know, I really wasn't happy. I was stealing from my friends, and, you know, it was lying to them about stuff and just trying to be cool and wrecking my car, you know, sucking on nitrous while driving, you know, and going off the road. I went off the road and hit a tree. I was real smart. I got in an accident one time, and I'm sitting in the back of the cop car with some weed in my sock, and somehow he didn't get me for that, and I didn't get taken in. The other time I went off the side of the road, hit a tree, and was completely uninjured, walked up the street, man pulled up and said, "Are you okay? Do you need any help?" And I said, "Yeah, I wrecked my car." He's like, "You want to call somebody?" I said, "Sure." And he has a phone in his car. Now, that's not unusual today, but this was 1987. The guy had a phone in his car, like the first person that pulled up. And, of course, I just went out and partied and then went home and got up in the morning. My parents were like, "Where's your car?" And that was about right before I got sober. And I remember the last weekend before I got sober, I was sitting in a parking lot, which was almost right across the street from a clubhouse that I wound up going to back then, with the nitrous can and some weed and a bottle, just miserable. Absolutely freaking miserable, just like, I can't do this anymore. I can't do this anymore. Like, this is going nowhere. Because I was going out there and just hanging out by myself, you know, getting little. Well, nobody was free to go out or do anything. Everybody was busy, or I just wanted to use it all for myself, so I would just do that. And I was just completely miserable, and I was like, this has got to stop. And I'd already been kind of given that direction from my family, so that next day is when I went, and I wound up in meetings and, you know, fell right in immediately. Made some good friends, had a lot of fun, a lot of fellowship, a lot of service work, a lot of good people. I started chairing meetings at 30 days. I was, I was like Wonder Boy in service work. I started secretary of a group at a clubhouse at 6 months. You know, had the key and would go in and set up and make the coffee and pick the chairperson and all that. And by the time I had a gear, I was an activities chair. I was in charge of putting on dances, and it was a lot of fun. Dances were a thing back in the late 80s, early 90s. People actually went to them, so you would put them on, and people would show up and pay money to hear some DJ play records. And it was a lot of fun. It was just really a lot of fun, and a lot of good people. The sponsors that I had, I had one sponsor, and really I had one sponsor that would just, it was almost like being counseled. You know, we would just talk about stuff. And there was never really a lot of big push on the steps. And the one I had for the longest period of time in those first early days of sobriety, he actually did work the steps with me, and it wasn't through the big book. He had like some, something from like Hazelden or something, like workbooks he had me go through. But we got to, like, I think, the sixth step, I believe. I know I did a fifth step with him. And he would ask me about stuff like, "You're not doing that anymore, are you?" You know, that was like the extent of the sixth step for me. Like, "No, I don't do that anymore. I quit that thing." So, yeah. So, but that he was like my best friend. You know, we would do stuff together all the time. We'd hang out. We'd go to the store and like just whatever. We'd go out to eat, go to meetings and that sort of thing. But there was no really big push on finishing the steps. I sponsored a couple of people, never really did anything with them. You know, I just meet them and listen to them talk about what was going on with them and try to counsel them, because that's all I knew. That's all they had shown me in the meetings that I was going to. And that went on for about 12 years. I met a girl. We used to have this thing. They still have it, actually. It's not an AA function, but it's called Fun in the Sun. And they'd go to Panama City and have like a convention there. So I met this girl on the beach, and we wound up hitting it off. And I used to drive 3 hours to see her, and we wound up getting married, and she moved to Atlanta. And we wound up being married for, I guess, about a year. And she decided that she wanted to start drinking again, and which is, you know, we had stopped going to meetings, so, you know, obviously, you know, that can happen. People stop going to meetings, they decide to start drinking again, and she didn't want to come back. So that ended pretty quickly. And matter of fact, I moved in in my dad's house. She stayed in the apartment. I moved in with my dad's house, which was in the same part of town. And I saw her one time after I left. She came over and she was just upset and like she didn't know what to do, and I didn't have anything to offer because I wasn't present. You know, I didn't know how to be there for somebody. I knew how to be there for myself, and I hadn't really learned any humility or anything like that. So, I wasn't able to be there for her married, and I wasn't able to be there for her after. And I tried to look her up. A couple of years ago, actually, a friend of mine convinced me to look her up for amends, because it had never come up on anything, and found out she passed away in 2002. So I don't really need to say anything else more about her. Anyhow, I went, met somebody else pretty soon after that, probably about 6 months after that, and started going out and actually got married again pretty quickly, and had a kid. And by that time, I probably had about 8 years sober, maybe nine, and was still, you know, doing the service work, going to a lot of meetings, fellowship. Once got married and had a kid, though, most of that stuff really trickled off almost completely. I stopped going to a lot of meetings. I stopped hanging out with my friends. I stopped doing service work. And those were the things that were keeping me around. Those were the things that were keeping me coming back, keeping me sober. You know, had never actually completed the steps. And I think I had changed sponsors at that point and didn't really have anybody, again, working with me on the steps or pushing me to finish the steps and take someone else through them. So that was what was going on there. And we got very busy. We had a condo. You know, things need to be maintained, a lot of painting to be done, had a kid, you know, child rearing, had a job where I was still in the grocery business and I was working about 50 hours a week. I was in management at that time. And I pretty much stopped going to meetings almost altogether and wasn't really in touch with program people, but I sort of developed this persona as I don't drink. I'm not a drinker. I just don't drink. You know, people would ask me, and finally got to the point where I didn't even bring it up. Like, I just wouldn't say I don't drink because I would offer that sometimes ahead of time. I'd say, yeah, I don't drink. Then I just quit saying that altogether. I quit telling people about it. And, you know, unless they ask, and I just say, no, thank you, or, you know, I don't drink beer or whatever. And what do you drink? Well, I really don't drink anything. It just got to this thing where I really wasn't you know, it wasn't on my mind. I wasn't thinking about drinking. I wasn't interested in drinking. I was just, you know, consumed with myself and what I could get for me, and also, you know, what little minimal things I was doing in my family life. Again, not present, really just, you know, wanting for myself, you know, whatever movies I could watch or, you know, recreational activities I could do or anything I could do. Really, you know, a lot of escape, you know, still a lot of reading. And watched a lot of movies, watched a lot of TV, that kind of thing, unless I had to do something. But there were plenty of days where I was supposed to be painting that inside the house, and I don't know, 5-6 rooms that I was supposed to paint, and lived there 9 years and didn't even finish the interior of the house. I was just not focused on anything at all unless I absolutely had to do it. I did pretty well at work. For the most part, didn't do really well at home. Would forget things, break things, leave the garage door open, absent-minded, just not present, not a present, aware person at all. But, you know, somehow we managed to stay together for a long time and got our kid up to be about 16. And by the time our son got to be about 16, I was thinking, you know, this isn't going to last. But, you know, let me get the kid through high school, and then I'll figure out, you know, then I'll get out of here. But I don't want to, like, abandon the kid in high school. Around about that time, I was working at a store where I was in charge of buying the beer and wine. And which is fine if you're, you know, practicing the principles and you're a sober alcoholic. And I was a dry alcoholic, and it really wasn't fine at all. For a while it was. But, you know, I would have to learn about it. You know, I'd ask questions. And, you know, I would say, well, tell me about, you know, they would tell me. They'd teach me about the wine and what it tastes like and the profiles and then all these new beers coming out. You know, there'd be a new beer, you know, every 2 weeks or 2 months there'd be a new beer. And the guy would be telling me, yeah, it's got this kind of beginning and this kind of finish. And, you know, it started sounding a little interesting, but I thought, well, I'm not going to drink. I don't drink. But, you know, the longer I was in that marriage and the less I was working on myself and trying to avoid responsibility, the more depressed I got. And, you know, it got to the point where when I wasn't working, I'd already moved into the guest room by that time and would just sit on the bed and watch TV and really didn't want to do anything else. I did absolutely the minimum of what I had to do there and just barely enough to get by at work also. And it was getting pretty worn down at work. It was pretty physically demanding. I was having a lot of trouble with it. Wound up just decided one night, you know what, I'm going to drink. You know, I didn't even think about it. And when I read this responsees now, when I read about the guy putting the whiskey and the milk in the book, it's a completely different story, but it's exactly like me. I didn't think about what I'm throwing away. I didn't think about, you know, I had just picked up a 25-year. I went to a meeting and just picked up a blue chip. 25 years. I had 25 years without drinking. And 2 weeks later, I decided I needed to drink. I wasn't even thinking about drinking when I picked up the chip. Wasn't even thinking that was something I was going to do. Was just completely oblivious to the fact that I was headed out the door. But I had backed way out of the circle. And I had been going to meetings trying to reconnect. But I was going to some pretty small meetings, daytime meetings at clubhouses, and really not, you know, it was just one guy. As a matter of fact, it was funny, I ran into him at the store yesterday, and I forget how many years he was celebrating at a meeting yesterday, and I wound up not going. I forgot about it. Actually, I was going to run by there before my home group. But, you know, it was like this fellow was like the only person that I even semi-connected with, and he was so busy that, you know, we weren't able to get together or meet or hang out or anything. I didn't really put a lot of effort into it. I didn't put any humility into it. I figured, you know, I got all this time. I shouldn't be, you know, like this, or this shouldn't be my situation, or I shouldn't be feeling this way, or, you know, I should offer something. You know, it was all about me and what I was thinking about myself. And, again, not thinking about my family or anything else like that. And when I decided to drink that night, I didn't think about those things either. And I didn't think about any of that stuff. I didn't think about the time. I didn't think about the family. I didn't think about the fact that I'd be driving home drunk. I didn't think about the fact that I'd be at work drunk, because here I am working in the grocery store, stealing alcohol and drinking at work. I think I drank four different things that night. And I'm the manager, right? And I handle the beer and wine, so, like, nobody's really paying attention to what I'm doing. The other managers have gone for the night. It's after 7. You know, I got till midnight, you know, to get my drink on. And I continued to do it. And I developed a very sneaky, which isn't surprising, method of stealing the beer that, you know, where I could stash it in... I would work the beer. I'd take the beer, I'd load it, I'd put a cold one in on the cart, put the warm one on the shelf, take the back stock to the back, rip open the plastic bags of plastic coverings, close it back up. Oh, it's time to take the recycling out. Take it out, pick it up on the way home, you know, drink all the way home, drink it while I'm at work. You know, I'm sitting in the office in the back, in the corner, you know, with the drawer with nothing in it and my cup of beer in there, you know, and my other beers, and I'm drinking beer while I'm pretending to work at the computer. And just, you know, they have no concept of, you know, this is really wrong. I probably shouldn't be doing this, but, like, I was like, I needed the relief, I thought, and that's what I did. Well, I finally got busted. My wife found my stash in the garage. I had a little desk in there. It's just all this beer I'd stolen. And she's like, are you done? And I said, I don't know. She's like, well, you can't drink and live here. So I've been here before. Okay, I'm done. And so... we threw everything away, went to a meeting, I picked up a chip, a white chip, and started going to meetings again. And I was surprised at how supportive she was. I thought she'd really be angry, really be upset, and she said, you know, just, you know, go do your thing, or whatever. And so a week later, she and my son were both out of town, and I decided that since I didn't have any vodka while I was out, I would just have vodka that one time. I'm going to have vodka today. And I went and got some really cheap vodka and some orange juice, and I'm mixing a drink. I'm like, I really don't feel anything of that. I'm going to make it stronger next time. I'm going to make the next one even stronger. And by the time I was done, I drank almost the whole fifth of vodka. And I hadn't had that much to drink in that kind of quantity. I was just drinking large quantities of beer before that. And my kid came home, and my kid saw me drunk. I'm one of those guys that can't say my kid never saw me drunk. And I was terrified. And I'm slurring words I'm certain I blacked out, because I woke up the next day and saw all the clean dishes, and I had vague memories of cooking something on the grill, and that all the dishes were clean, the food was put away. It's like, well, I remember I ate and I cooked, but I don't remember any of this other stuff. So I experienced a blackout, like the ones I used to have when I drank whole fists when I was, you know, 18. That was back when, you know, and people would just give me stuff. It was stupid, like Benadryl, like when I was 18. Take these Benadryl, you know, just to mess with me. And the next day, he's like, remember we went to Stubby's party and you threw up? And I said, who's Stubby? There was many days like that. So it was the first time I'd experienced that in a long time. I had forgotten how weird it was. So, of course, you know, the wife comes home on Monday. And I had already gone to a meeting and picked a white chip. So I'm good, right? We're all good. She's like, you know what, I told you can't drink and live here. And here I am thinking, well, I thought, I didn't say this, but I thought you can't drink and live here meant you can't drink all the time and live here. Not like you can't just have one more, because there's only one more time. And so I was asked to leave. And, I don't know, you know, who knows, you know, if things could have worked out if I had straightened my act out. But it was things were pretty far gone by that point. There was a lot of damage done over the years in my inconsistency, my irresponsibility, that sort of thing. And not sure if I even have returned to any full level of responsibility yet. A lot better than I used to be. And I started going to a meeting at a clubhouse and got a sponsor, and we worked the steps in the parking lot over the course of a few days. And like I had like a page of a four step, and we did a fifth step, and he's like, "All right, 6 and 7, yep, okay, we're good." We did the prayer and everything. He's like, "All right, now just work on 10, 11, and 12. I said, "Thanks, sponsor." Went on about my business, and there was a young lady at the meeting that. But we got to be good friends. She was really cool, and we had a lot of laughs and all that. And I thought we were just going to be friends. I wasn't, like, looking for anything, but apparently she thought otherwise, because we went to hang out after a meeting one night and get something to eat, and she's like, "This is a date." And I said, "Okay, well, I guess this is what I'm doing now." And I think I had 90 days. She was great. She was really cool. I liked her. She was cute, funny, smart. Anyhow, she had, like, 90 days. I had 90 days. She had 7 months, and my sponsor was telling me, like, "Ryan, all I can tell you is, you know, she's only got 7 months, buyer beware." You know, later I'm thinking, why is he telling me, like, don't do that? Like, if I had the sponsorship line that I have now, they would say, "What the F are you thinking? Don't go there." It lasted about a month. She somehow got un-okay with the fact that I was still married. I don't know what happened there. It was the fact that we were keeping the relationship a secret because of that, and it might have bothered her a little bit. She's really, really a sweet person, and she's happily married now. So I'm glad for her for that. Don't really see her around much anymore, and when I do, we just, you know, say hello and that's it, which is fine. I'm just grateful. You know, she made it through okay. She didn't get drunk again. I did. See, here's the thing. They say don't get in a relationship early in sobriety, but it's so wonderful that this person is perfect for me, and like everything's good, and like we're gonna. And it does work all the time, sometimes. I'm not saying it doesn't work. But for me, it was a bad decision. The fact is, I had nothing to fall back on. I had no good sponsorship line. I had no strength. I had no steps that I had worked. I had no spiritual program of action. I wasn't sponsoring people. I had nothing to take my mind off the fact that I was completely heartbroken and sad and depressed for months. Months and months and months and months. It was insane. My roommate was like, "You need to get out of the house. We're going to go to a movie." And I remember going to the movie and being surprised. Like, there was, like, spans of 2 minutes where I wasn't actually thinking about her because the movie distracted me. I was just that far gone with that whole thing. Yeah, good. I started going to the Fit Tradition, and I got a sponsor there and was going through the steps, but you know, I was just not being fully honest about what was going on in my life. I wasn't telling them about the heartbrokenness, which is makes no sense. But a lot of things I do don't make sense, especially then. And I had this friend that got a felony conviction, and he was a gun owner. He had a lot of guns, and he's like, "I got to get these guns out of my house." You know, and he had helped me with a lot of stuff. He'd helped because I had child support and I agreed to pay a pretty good amount. And between that, you know, he gave me a break on the rent, and I'm living in his house. He's like, "I got to get these guns out of here." Let's just put them in my trunk. I had a Chrysler Concord, big trunk. You could fit like two dead bodies in there, live bodies. And so we put like three or four rifles, a bunch of ammunition in my trunk. And I'm just driving around with this stuff in my trunk. I'm not telling anybody about it. I'm going to my sponsor's house to do a fifth step with the guns and ammo in the trunk. Don't say a word about it. Do my fifth step. Half-assed, fourth step, by the way. My sponsor was a real matter-of-fact, really good guy, and I'm friends with him today. But, you know, very matter-of-fact about things. And that was probably in the fall. And by December, you know, I was just over it. I wasn't dealing with everything. I wasn't telling people what was going on with me. I wasn't sharing openly. I wasn't being honest. And I wound up deteriorating so bad from my heartbrokenness and some physical pain that I was having, that probably resulting from my depression and other things. But I wound up just missing work. I would be late for work. I'd leave work early. I'd miss days. I would make up excuses not to come to work. And when the company that I worked for and the type of job that I had, it's not acceptable to do that. You just don't. I was a department manager, and they demoted me to a hourly clerk, transferred me to another store. And I was devastated. I was like, I can't pay my child support now. I can't pay anything. I can't do anything for anybody. I can't even do anything for myself. I can't even do my job. I went in there and I'm stocking shelves. Like, this is insane. Like, I can't even do this. And it's just, it wasn't even about the humiliation. It was the fact that I felt, well, I'm just going to do it, right? This is what I'm here. I'm supposed to do this. You know, they didn't fire me and all that. And here I am trying to do it. And, I had this very clear, logical idea that since I can't do this, and I can't be there for anybody, I'm just going to kill myself. And it was very logical. Like, I just thought it through, and it's like, well, that's probably the best solution here. Of course, I didn't tell anybody. Not to mention the fact that I didn't tell my sponsor. I'd lost a family member to suicide, unfortunately, and I'm just, you know, completely oblivious to anything like that. I wound up getting drunk a few nights, taking a bunch of pills, and had a horrible night. Was up half the night, just up and down, up and down, up and down, And the next week, I spent on the couch. My roommate had been through some depression stuff before. He'd give me an insurer in the morning and an insurer in the evening when he left work and came back. And I just stayed on there with the TV on the whole time, slept, woke up, slept, woke up. Finally called my sponsor, and all he had to say was, take a shower, shave, get up in the morning, go to your morning meeting, and come back and work on your resume. And, from his point of view, I can understand why he would operate like that, but that wasn't what I wanted to hear, so I thought I needed a new sponsor. And wound up getting another sponsor, and he wound up working with some, not being able to sponsor guys anymore. He just kind of drifted off. He's still sober. And then I got another sponsor, so I was working with this guy. And we got to the ninth step. And he started telling me stuff about the ninth step. He had this long conversation one night. We met in a restaurant to go over the ninth step. He's like, you owe these financial amends. This is not your money. This is their money. Set up a payment plan. I said, yeah, but, you know, I didn't even have a regular income. I had taken a job working with somebody I knew that had a recruiting firm and was commission only. So I was like, I don't know what my income's going to be. You know, I'm going to make it here and there, but I really can't do a payment plan. I really can't do that. I don't know what to do. So I decided I'd reached an impasse with this guy and wound up getting somebody else to sponsor me because of that. And I pretty much had it with my home group at that point, too, because they were not friendly. They didn't like me. I never got invited to anything. Yeah, if you can imagine the kind of person I was, who would want me around? So it got to the point that I was just fed up with them. I didn't feel happy there. I didn't feel comfortable there. I didn't like them. They didn't like me. I'm going to go to this other meeting. I'm going to a men's meeting and make it my home group, right, because I'm hanging with the boys and it's going to be good. And turns out they didn't like me that much either, and they didn't accept it. I was pretty much in this, like, they're being judgmental and unloving toward me. So I'm going to go to this other group. And they were just as judgmental and unloving. What is with these people? And I realized after I came back that this time that, you know, that I was the one being judgmental and unloving and you know, blaming them for my stuff. And I got a real easy sponsor. You know, he didn't even do a written 11-step every night. And I'd already gotten through the ninth step with this guy, and I told him about the impasse that we reached. And he said, "Yeah, you don't have to do all that right now, Ryan. It's good." And I remember calling that guy when my ass was on fire one time. He didn't call me back, and it was kind of weird. I'd gotten fired from my job, so the guy that I worked with got real upset with me. He had come into work. He was in the program, and he had come into work drunk after lunch. And I was supposed to take him to the airport that day, and I said, I can't take you to the airport like that. So he said, okay, you're fired. And I probably shouldn't have been staying there as long as I wasn't making any money. Here I am just going along with life, right? Not even thinking about, well, the fact that I'm really not making anything, because I'm not, the job, you know, it was a commission job, and I wasn't closing any deals. So I'm not making any money. I'd gotten all this money from the company that I'd left, and I'm living off that, right, and burning it up pretty quick, not being responsible with it at all. But not extravagantly, just not, you know, managing it well. And so, you know, I got to the point again where I'm living in a place with a roommate in had a condo in Avondale, and this fellow, he moved out. The lease was about to be up. And I had pretty much quit going to meetings by that point. That was in the summer of 2015, and I had quit going to meetings by then. I had pretty much stopped almost altogether. I just had slowly backed out of the circle once again, one step at a time. And, you know, the lease was about to be up, and he moved out in the middle of the month. And I had just been staying in my room all the time. It was like one of those movies where, like, the guy stays in his room all the time, you never see him, and, like, I only came out when he wasn't there. What was that, Shallow Grave? Kind of reminded me of that, but there was no money involved, unfortunately. And nobody died, which is good. So, you know, he was telling somebody that thought I was using heroin, like, that's how bad it looked. And really, I was just writing bad checks and drinking a lot of craft beer and, you know, trying to find people to chat with online just to talk to somebody about something, because I was completely like, I don't want these AA people, but I'll talk to a stranger, you know, and that sort of thing. So that's pretty much what I was doing. And wrote a bunch of bad checks because I had run out of money. And I decided that I was, again, I couldn't do life. I was coming up on 49 years old, and I couldn't do life anymore. Like, I can't do this anymore. I mean, like, I'm a mess. I'm a wreck. I can't even get up and go to work. I can't get a job. I can't stay sober, you know, so I'm just going to drink and die. And I kept putting it off. You know, it's like, Kroger took my check again. I guess I'm not going to die this week. And I would just keep going back, and eventually, you know, the place just stopped taking my checks. And I said, well, this is it. So I, like, drank my final thing, and I'm just about to use the method I'd chosen, and I thought, you know what, that seems kind of painful. Let me look this up. So I'm looking it up. And there was a friend of mine that had been keeping in touch with me, and he's still friends with mine today. I'd been there for him. I actually went and sat with him in the hospital when he was at before he went to Peachford last time, because they had some medical stuff that he had to deal with. And I went and sat with him in the hospital one time, and he's been sober a year now. Anyhow, and we had kind of been each other, there for each other, and he had always been, you know, I didn't have phone service, but I still have my phone and I had Wi-Fi, so he'd message me on Messenger like every couple of weeks or every week and check on me. And so anyway, I said, all right, I'm going to look up this suicide thing, and I'm reading about it. It's like 98% of suicides end in failure. Oh, you usually wind up being maimed or mentally incapacitated. And that scared the crap out of me more than being alive. So decided to give the life thing one more shot, and went to sleep and got up, messaged that guy the next day. He said, I can't come down there. I said, let me call a couple people. So he notified a couple people. He notified the guy that had tried to get me to contact my first wife to make amends, who had been a good friend of mine, and another fellow who was in my home group. And the home group guy contacted me same day, or the next day, and said, let's go to a meeting tomorrow. And the guy came, picked me up, went to a meeting. And it was great because he was probably the person I cared about and trusted most in that group. We'd been friends already before. And so, you know, I asked him to sponsor me, or he talked me into it. It was kind of a combination of the two. But he knew I needed a sponsor. And, you know, I picked up a white chip, and that was on December 1st of 2015, a year and 9 months ago. You know, sometimes when people come back, you know, a lot of times people ask them, what's going to be different this time? What are you going to do different? And I probably couldn't have answered that question any better than any of those guys can when we asked them that. But what I did do differently was I decided that I was going to be willing to have a different experience. I decided that, you know, whatever was going to happen, my willingness was going to be there to do something different, to listen. Because I kind of thought I knew things. Like, I'd been around before. I knew things. I kind of knew what the deal was. You know, I'd worked some steps. You know, I'd read the book. I'd, you know, done plenty of meetings and service work. You know, I kind of had kind of an ego about it, a lot of ego about it, actually. And I decided I was just going to let this fella tell me what to do and take me through the book and listen to what he had to say and not interject my own thoughts and ideas and things into it, and just listen to him and just tell him what was going on with me, and then listen to what his experience was around that and around early sobriety and what he suggested, and follow his suggestions. And we, you know, time, it was tough. You know, it was tough times. I was completely, you know, completely broke. I wound up getting evicted from that place that I was living in. And the fellow that had fired me when he was drunk came over and got my stuff, helped me put it in everything that I had been slowly, like, selling things. I was, you know, but sober. But, like, I knew I was going to get evicted. So he came over and got me out of there. And we moved me into a condo that he was living in because he was separated from his wife. And he had another room. And he, like, let me live there. And it was just, you know, it's just amazing. You know, when we want to stay sober and want to do the right thing, we never know who we're going to meet or what kind of people we're going to have in our lives and what kind of great things are going to happen for us. And it was not an easy situation. He was a difficult person. And, you know, I was working. So he invited me to come back and work with him. So I'm working, commission only. And I wound up getting a job, an evening job at a restaurant. So I was working 5 nights a week there. But I told the manager that I wanted Thursday nights off. And I said, can I have Thursdays and Saturdays? I don't think I can give you both. And I told him why. And he said, well, yeah, you know, I've had some relatives that suffered from that and, you know, lost some people due to alcoholism and addiction. So, yeah, I'll do that for you. And I didn't miss, I think I missed 2 meetings the 6 months that I worked there. And because they asked me to work. And he would come up to me and say, Brian, I need you to do me a favor. Can you work Thursday night? I'm like, of course I can work Thursday. Give me the Thursday night off. And, you know, it's just incredible, incredible bunch of folks there. And I had a lot of fun. It was very humbling because I had been, you know, in retail and management. And here I was, you know, being an associate among associates. They did put me on the register right away because I had experience. And they had me closing the store 2 nights a week. I'd been there like a month, and I'm closing. It was a small burrito place. But they had me closing the store 2 nights a week. And they loved that because the store manager didn't have to work open to close, so he was real happy with me. I would meet my sponsor once a week and went through the big book and worked the steps. And, you know, we went through the steps, and he was very, I was very honest with him. I told him what was going on and what was happening with me and kept him up to date on everything. And I had a different experience. I was honest. When I shared with him, I was honest with everything that was going on. I was honest with everything that bothered me, because there were always a lot of things that bothered me, but I didn't tell people about them. I had grown up not doing that, and, you know, I had to learn that that was the thing I had to do in order to deal with those things. And I had done fist steps before, so, like, all the big chunks were gone. So he said, well, just, you don't have any, I said, I don't have any resentments. I said, well, you got to have some resentments. I'll tell you what, I'll just put down the people that annoy me. So now when I do my nightly inventory, it says, you know, was I resentful? I have to think, for me, that means, did anybody annoy me today? Because that's my definition sometimes for resentment, is this person has been annoying me. And there have been people that ended up on that 11-step list that I wouldn't have put on there because I didn't think I was resentful, but they were annoying the crap out of me, so that bothered me, and I needed to put that on there. But I got a tremendous amount of insight in my fifth step around those things, because those things that annoy me and those other people were things that annoy me about myself that I wasn't looking at or being aware of or taking any action towards, and those things became my defects of character. You know, those are the things that I had to ask to be removed when I got to the step 6 and 7. And going back a little bit, I'm one of the people that actually felt something when we knelt down at the coffee shop to do the third step prayer, and that was part of the thing that I really felt like, you know, I'm moving in this direction, I'm going to keep doing this, you know, I'm really, and developed a connection with God through 6 and 7, worked on the 8th and 9th step, had a few amends to make, still have financial amends to make, it's a very slow process, but, you know, I have some that I'm consistently making, and others that I haven't begun yet, but the process takes time, and I'm making the effort toward it, and I know how important that is. I hear a lot of speakers talk about that, ones that have completed them, and what a weight they have lifted off their shoulders when those things are done. And it's about having a spiritual relationship with money also, and a spiritual relationship with others. It's about taking care of my mistakes, is doing that. And my 11th step that I do at night is kind of gives me an idea of how well I worked the 10th step that day. When I do a prayer meditation in the morning, I don't spend a lot of time on it. I read 86 through 88, and I think about my day. And I, you know, pray for guidance that my, you know, that I'm not thinking about myself and that I'm not self-pitying or dishonest in thinking about my day and going through my day. And it's, you know, it's the 12th step. There's a whole chapter devoted to it. We're going over it in our big book study at my home group right now. And I've had a couple of experiences. I've sponsored a few people. I haven't gotten anybody past step four yet. I had a guy that finished his step four. He was in a halfway house. He told me he was moving out the next week, and he moved out. And it was one of those places where you can't have a phone. And I don't know if he lost my number or what, but I was disappointed I didn't get to a fifth step with somebody. It was because I know we grow a lot from that, and I'm disappointed, and I hope he's okay. But I keep finding new guys to sponsor, and somebody will make it through at some point. I spoke at my home group last June at about 8 months sober, and told a similar story that is this shorter version, but I talked about how I had that much time and away from drink and had drank again. And after the meeting, this fellow comes up to me and asked me for my number. And he was probably, he was close to my age. And I didn't know him. And I said, sure, I'll give you my number. He called me the next day. He said, you told my story last night. I got 24 years. I'm going through the same thing you were going through. I'm married. I've got two kids. I'm not going to meetings. I'm not connected. I want to ask you if you'll take me through the steps. And I said, yeah, I don't know. Let me call my sponsor, because, like, I didn't feel qualified to do that at all. And my sponsor was like, yeah, maybe. And I called his sponsor, who I also know well, and he said, sure, go ahead and do it. I know that guy. You know, he's been around a while. I've encountered him before. Go ahead and do it. And I said, well, just... And so, you know, I started meeting with him, and I said, look, you know, I'm not the guy that's going to tell you what to do and all that kind of stuff and give you insight and anything like that. You know the basics of what to do as far as, like, how to behave, go to meetings, that sort of thing and all that. I said, well, let's just go through the book, and I'll share the experience that I had when I went through it. And we just spent a lot of time talking. We meet for an hour a week, and sometimes we read, like, two paragraphs, and then we just talk about stuff. And got to know each other really well. And I convinced him to go, at my sponsor's suggestion, convinced him to go to an AA event last summer. And he didn't know hardly anyone there. He said, I'm just going to go and talk to people that I don't know and just strike up conversations. And he wound up connecting with somebody that had been a previous sponsor of his. And then through that person, met his original sponsor. And he's now working with his original sponsor. And I've had to fight him for newcomers at the beginners meeting at my home group. Like, we're both trying to get sponsor the same guy. And the reason I tell that is because, you know, part of the promise is no matter how far down the scale we've gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. And, you know, I didn't feel like even coming back, I said, I'm just going to do this thing. I don't know. I don't think I have anything to offer. I'm just going to, you know, I know, you know, I can take somebody through the book and help them hopefully have a similar experience and that sort of thing. And then that's really, you know, what I have to offer. And, you know, I was able to, you know, share that experience and reach somebody, and he was able to be humble enough to say, hey, I need help, and was able to get reconnected and not have to go through what I went through to maintain sobriety and have a good, happy, sober life, which he does now. I still see him regularly, and he's doing really well. There's a lot of fun things I get to do. My creativity really started going crazy last summer, and what's meaningful about this to me is that, you know, there's an outlet. I have an outlet for things that I think of that are crazy or wacky or weird that I can't use in conversation, or I'm not going to say to you from a podium or anywhere else. That you know, that I have an outlet for these creative things that I think of, and I have the fellow that that the person I contacted when I wanted to come back. He and I have been. I just met him through a mutual friend, and he and I have been, he plays guitar and I sing, and we've been doing music for like 3 years now. And when we played at Napa Coffee House a bunch of times, and then we actually started getting paying gigs, and we, you know, we do covers, and we're serious about it. We try to make it sound good, and but it's fun. You know, I get to have fun doing that. Like, that's something fun that I get to do. You know, I've gotten to do some I love comedy. I got to do some open mic stand-up comedy, and it's only for fun. Like, I don't want to get anything out of it other than just the experience, because it's something that I've always enjoyed. Then, well, I get to do it too. I've always enjoyed music. Well, I get to do it too. I've always enjoyed reading. I've written some stuff. Nothing really great. Nothing that I not didn't expect I'm going to become a writer of any kind or a published author, so to speak. But, you know, creativity is something that allows me to just, it helps me grow a little bit. And it helps me say things and express things that I'm not going to express, again, you know, in a group of people or one-on-one, or maybe one-on-one with people that, like, understand, but, like, and just let it out, and it's good. I'll close with this. I know we're almost out of time here. Bill talks about how we are rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence in joy and happiness and that sort of thing. And I was joking, as I often do, with a friend of mine, actually just the guy at the home group, and I said, you know, it says the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically, but what about financially and emotionally, you know, this fake drama thing and all that. And he's completely serious. I'm going to send you a talk. And he sends me this talk, and it's a Sandy Beach talk. And Sandy Beach does a lot of these talks that program in two words, let go. He's done several like that. And in this particular one, and he probably says it in other ones too, he says, I wish I had a spiritual watch. That way, when anybody asks me what time it is, I can say, it's right now. You ever go there? That millisecond between resentments of the past and fear of the future? It's right now. It's always right now. It's never any other time than right now. And that just had a tremendous impact on me at that time. And it's fantastic because every time I see that guy, one of us is going to ask the other one, what time is it? And, of course, the correct answer is right now or RFN or, you know, something. You know, we say, we just say there's no time like the present. And it's a great reminder. And he had actually traveled to Pennsylvania recently, and I was texting trying to get a copy of that talk for somebody else. And he texted me, you know, Brian, it's the same time in Pennsylvania as it is in Georgia. And I thought about it for a second. I said, yeah, well, it's in the same time zone. Then I realized what he was doing. And it was like, he almost got me with that one. And it's fun, but it also really is a tremendous way that I, for me to live when I can do it, when I really try to do it. If I'm on my way to a meeting to speak, which has never happened before, tonight, I know I'm not supposed to be thinking about what I'm going to talk about. I wanted to cover this, and I want to make sure I shared that thing about my mom and all that. And like, I was like, all right, bookend, you know, we're good. And everything else is just going to come out that as God wants it to come out. But, you know, all I have to do is drive the car and enjoy the music. I don't have to do anything else. I don't have to think about anything else. I don't have to think about the past. I don't have to think about the future. I don't have to worry. I don't have to obsess. You know, people talk about, when, you know, we talk about when we come in, you know, how the obsession will be removed. You know, we get sober and we work the steps and the obsession to drink is removed. And they also talk about when we come in, just take it one day at a time. And you know what? If you're having trouble not taking that drink one day at a time, take it a moment at a time. And then with sobriety, when the obsession is removed and I have the psychic change, that still can be in my life because I'm taking everything a day at a time or a moment at a time. And all my obsessions have been removed. I don't obsess about anything all day long. Maybe for a few seconds, and then I'm really good at overthinking. You know, it's going to take me 15 minutes to tell you something I can overthink in 15 seconds just because I'm so good at it. But it really comes down to the fact that you know, that's, and I think about what am I, you know, especially like when I don't like the way I'm feeling or I don't like what's going on, like work sucks today. You know, I'm not, you know, where am I? I'm at work. What am I supposed to be doing? Working. What do I do for my job? Well, I call people on the phone. So what should I do? I should pick up the phone and call somebody. And then when I'm done with that, I'm going to make another phone call or whatever it is I'm supposed to be doing. And I'm not thinking about, well, what I'm going to have for lunch or what I'm going to do when I get off work. Plan that, but don't think about it, worry about it, and try to pass my time thinking about that when I really should be thinking about what's in front of me. And so living the moment too is about taking care of what's in front of me, and it brings me a lot of peace, and it brings me a lot of hope, because, you know, when that day is done, you know, I have my plan, and I have the plan, and I just do what I'm supposed to. I take care of what's in front of me most of the time, and it usually works out extremely well. So that's what I wanted to end with. And then in vision for you at the end, it says, we realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But we cannot transmit something we haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Then he goes to the steps. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you. Until then.